Good morning. Hope you all are doing well, and I don't guess it's too out of line to say Happy Easter. I think it's safe to say from the songs that were called out, our minds are on the resurrection. That's not strange. And thinking that in a way will be the subject, not exactly, but from what Jesus accomplished in his being resurrected, he achieved a new beginning. Nothing was quite the same after that. It was a seal that things had been changed, and that was the greatest new beginning. That's really the phrase I want us to stick in our minds as we look at the subject matter that we have before us. How we have new beginnings, how he gives us new beginnings. The new beginnings that are there before us that we can lay hold on, that are there because he has brought them about. Now, of the resurrection itself, the main thing I want to say about that subject itself is it gives this whole thing relevancy. Without his resurrection, none of this is relevant to us. Because as we'll start in 1 John chapter 1, and basically we're starting at the end. We're going to go to where I want to go and come back around to this. But I want this to be the preface of our thoughts because of our thoughts about the resurrection and it giving us new beginning. And the fact that Jesus is alive now, that after the resurrection, he didn't die again, and he never will, that gives relevance to what we're about to read here in John. What John is telling us is something that he says happens to, he's talking about a process, an event that happens continually to Christians, to children of God, and if he's not alive, it can't happen because he is the facilitator of the event. Now, he describes it here in chapter 1, and later on down, we'll just read, start in verse 6. He says, "If we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not the truth. If we are in a state where we think we're walking with him, or at least we say we're walking with him, and we're actually not, We do not the truth. We lie. We're lying to ourselves. We're just lying in general. And we're not doing the truth. We can think we're in the way and not actually be in the way." He says, "But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another. And the blood of Jesus Christ, his son, cleanseth us from all sin." Brings us to a new beginning. The blood of Christ cleanseth. Continually cleanseth us from all sin. I would say I like to look at this block of verses as the description of God saving us from ourselves. This is the description of God saving us from ourselves, saving us from coming into a state where we lie about where we think we are, where we wish we were as people. And he says, if we say that we have no sin, not only do we just basically lie, he says, we deceive ourselves. That's an amazing statement. For about a year now, that one statement, that idea, just smacked me in the face. The idea that we can deceive ourselves. I want that to just be an overriding thought over what we consider this morning. That not only will we seek to deceive others in some things, and we'll deal with those particular things I want to talk about, but we'll even seek, and necessarily so, deceive ourselves. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. We're lying, basically. If we confess our sins, the converse to that, the opposite to that is, if we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness, to basically save us from ourselves, save us from the lies that we tell, save us from the state that we want to think we're in, to a state of reality, to a state of truth in all things. Now, just looking at what is said here, we look for sin. We look at for ourselves to be honest about whether we're in sin or not in sin, basically whether we're in the right or in the wrong, and to be honest about that. And if we find ourselves to be in the wrong and we confess that to God, he can renew us to a right state. He can cleanse us from all sin, cleanse us from ourselves. But if we say we have no sin, then we have deceived ourselves, we have tried to deceive others, and we have not experienced a new beginning. He's saying there's a new beginning for us. When we are wrong, there can be a new beginning. But it's a new beginning we can neglect by not confessing our sin. Now, I want to illuminate that of all that I speak of there by looking at the 15th chapter of Luke. Knowing that as we look at this, I want us to be thinking about new beginnings, the new beginnings that are possible. And since they're just possible, they're not necessarily going to happen. But that God is the facilitator of them, and they can happen through Him. The book of Luke, chapter 15, we're going to deal with a parable that Jesus spoke, and we're all relatively familiar with. But I want us to look at it and try and get the full scope of what He's teaching. And the first way that you see what Christ is teaching with a parable or anything He's saying is to look at the subject that He's speaking to. Who is He teaching? To get the full context of what He's teaching. He never taught just, you know, offhandedly for no reason. There was a reason He said everything He said. There was a purpose to it. There's an extrapolated purpose for us, and there was a specific purpose for the people He was talking to at the time. And we need to understand that to get the full scope of what He was teaching. This is one of, I feel, the paramount parables. So one of the ones that gets into a lot of the most important things that He taught. The most important things for us and most relevant to us. And that's why I want to look at it as well. But to see the setup, we'll look at the first verse of the 15th chapter. It tells us what was happening around Him at the time. And it's very integral to the parable itself. It says, "Then drew near unto Him, unto Jesus, all the publicans and sinners for to hear Him." They get near Him. The publicans and the sinners, they form this inner circle, if you will, around Him. Notice just real quickly that it mentions them and describes them as the publicans. We know what those were. They were the tax collectors. They were typically Jews, but they worked for the Roman government. Not only did they collect taxes from their brethren, they collected more than they were supposed to line their pockets, as I understand it. So they were despised by the elite. The common Jew didn't like them very much. They were outside of the highest social order because of it, because of their profession. And it calls the other ones sinners. That's strange to me. That these people, we know where they were. They lived their lives in such a way. They had activities that they involved themselves in that people would look at them and call them. They could put the label on them of sinner, right? They could call them sinners because they were either drunkards or they were prostitutes or they were thieves or whatever it was that they did. They could be labeled easily, without dispute, sinners. Nobody said, "Well, I'm not sure if he's a sinner." They were sinners. That was how society viewed them. The sinners and the publicans gathered near Him, and they formed this inner circle. And the Pharisees and scribes, the upper crust of the social construct, at least the upper 50%, they were not the lower. They were not considered sinners. They certainly were not publicans by trade. They were the religious people, the Pharisees, the ones who were known to be very religious, who flaunted their religion. They were the religious of the society. The scribes were the ones who wrote things down. They had a notable profession as well. And they were close together with the Pharisees. So they're there, and they can hear Him enough to murmur against Him and what he's doing. So you've got the inner circle of the scene is you've got Jesus in the center, the publicans and sinners on the outside, and the Pharisees and the scribes are there. But they're there murmuring against Jesus. And look at what they say. "This man receiveth sinners and eateth with them." That was their charge against Him. They were always looking for something to make Him look like He was less than they were. What they're saying is He's doing something we would not do. And because He's doing that, He's a sinner. He's wrong. He's different from us. He's not to be respected like He is. He's not deserve His respect. So when Jesus begins speaking and speaks these parables, he's speaking to the people that are right around him, but he's also speaking to the people that are murmuring against him. So when you see the two characters in the story of what we call the parable prodigal son, it is about the prodigal son, but it's also about the father, and it's also about his older brother, the younger son's older brother. So I want us to see those three, and I want us to see how they connect to those people and how that in turn connects to us, and in the context of what we've already said as the preface, the new beginning. And he begins, and he speaks two parables to begin with. He talks about, and we won't read every verse, but he starts out by talking about a shepherd having 100 sheep. One gets away, runs away, whatever, and is out from the flock. So he leaves the 99... and he goes after this one sheep. He finds him. When he finds him, he's elated. He's happy. It says he lays him on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he came home, he called together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost." Now, I want to just derive one point from that. You could probably preach the entire sermon on that. But the one point I want to get out of that is it shows a lack of intrinsic value. The sheep was not worth, if you're talking about what it could bring at market, it's not worth as much as the 99. Never. There's no sheep that was in such perfect condition that one sheep could be worth more than the 99 sheep. You could have one diamond that's so big and perfect that it's more perfect, that it's worth more than 99 small diamonds, right? But not with sheep. Okay, so when he goes after the sheep, there's no intrinsic value within the sheep that causes him to go out and get it. The value of the sheep is on the value that is placed on it by the shepherd. You see what I mean? It's because he loves the sheep. It's nothing the sheep could do or be worth. It's not worth that to you. It wouldn't be worth that to me. But it's worth going out and hazarding himself to the shepherd. So it's not about intrinsic value. It's not about what the sheep would bring in market. It's about what the sheep means to the shepherd. And that is a value that doesn't go up and down with the market changes. It's a value that always stays the same. Okay? So we see the true value of the sheep only in the shepherd. Then we have the parable of the coin. The lady who has a set of, I believe it was 10 coins, and she loses one. It's somewhere in her house. So she sweeps her house, finds it, puts it back together with the other nine, and she calls together her friends to have a party because she's found the one coin that was missing from the set. So we see how the individual has a value placed on it by the owner, the shepherd, the caretaker, the one who has it in his possession. But also, there is a value of the set. God is not going, this woman was not going to be happy with just nine. You know, nine's a good number. 99's a good number. But she's not going to be happy with an incomplete set. God is not happy with an incomplete set. There's a certain number that's going to be in heaven. And if there were one less, he wouldn't be happy at all. He rejoices over the one. He needs the one. He loves the one. He loves the all. And when he finds him, he's happy. The lady was elated. She was happy. If you've ever lost your car keys, you know what it means to be, you know, searching frantically, especially when it's getting close to time you need to go to work. You need those car keys. I've been in that situation. Most of us have. If in the process of looking for your car keys, you find a $20 bill, that's great, but it's not going to start your car, right? You're going to continue to hunt until you find those car keys. Now, again, going back really toward the shepherd, those car keys don't mean anything to me because they don't fit my car. They mean everything to you because they fit yours. Value is something that cannot just be placed on what someone is worth or what they've done. It's about the other person who needs it, who loves it, who then places a greater value than anyone else would. So we see how a shepherd can love his sheep. We see how a woman can love her collectibles, how a woman can love this coin. But he then raises the bar to a love that really, I believe, is the greatest love we can understand. And that is the greatest love that exists among humankind, and that is the love between a parent and a child. There is no greater that I, in my assessment, having not even have had kids, just in my observation, it trumps the love of a man toward his wife and a wife toward her husband. It trumps everything else. Nothing a parent wouldn't do for their child. They would die for them. They would go to hell and back for them. They would literally do anything for their children, a parent who loves their child. There are some who don't, but they're in the minority. And he begins by saying, a certain man had two sons. Notice that he doesn't begin his narrative with the younger son. He begins the narrative with the father. And I think that's important. He says, a certain man had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me. And he divided unto them his living. The younger son just wants to go live on his own. He wants to live by his own rules. He wants to live his life how he wants to live his life. And he knows that in his father's house, he is restricted to some degree. And he doesn't like those restrictions. He wants to live in a way that his father wouldn't approve of. And so he says, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. Give me my inheritance. Divide that basically early. I don't know how often this happened. I doubt that it was the common practice. Common practice was probably more like it is now, where the inheritance was divided out after a man died. But he divides it early before his death, and he takes that inheritance, and he, not many days after receiving it, goes off into a far country and spends all his money on riotous living. He gets into what would be the equivalent of today, drugs and alcohol and women, and he just spends all his money. Sin is expensive, and he spends all his money. Once he runs out of money, not only has he run out of money, but a famine comes into the land. So now he's been caught at the worst time to be out of money. He not only doesn't have any, but he can't really start anything to make some more. Even if he was an industrious and smart individual, he can't start a business with no money. He's stuck. He's got to manually hire himself out. So the only thing he finds is a man who puts him to work feeding his pigs. And the man in the country where he's at, who sends him to feed his pigs, doesn't care about him. And the people who are living in that area, who see him every day, they don't care about him. It says no man gave unto him. He's working every day. I don't know how much he worked, but obviously he wasn't getting anything to eat. And I know from my experience, you have to eat to work. It's fuel for the body, and when you don't, you notice it. I can miss one meal and try to work for, 5-6 hours, and you really feel it. You can't work to your optimum capacity. It just doesn't work that way. So here, he's not eating much at all, and he's feeding pigs. He's doing manual labor. I don't know how much, but he's doing manual labor. And he's getting tired. He's getting famished. He's getting sick of this life that he's living. He's going through the motions, but he is in a bad state, feeding pigs, out of a father's house who was obviously not a poor man at all, a man of at least some substance. I think we can deduce that he had some substance. So he's gone from living in a decent, at least, substantive house to feeding pigs. And so far, he's okay with it. He's making it on his own. He's walking the path that he's chosen. He's his own man. He's living his own life. But things are going really not like he thought they would. And things are getting pretty dire. It's not just that things aren't optimal. It's not just that his life isn't like he hoped it would be. It's getting to the point where it's dangerous. The man doesn't care about him. Nobody else cares about him. And he's getting so hungry that he could die from his hunger. He gets so hungry that it says he fain would have eaten of... Well, let's read that. He says, in the 16th verse, and he would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. And then it says he came to himself. He had an epiphany. He had a changing, a turn. This was the turning point for him. Because this stuff, that the first day he loads that on his shoulders, carries it to the pigs, puts it in the trough, he's turning his nose up. It's the same stuff I don't know how, they probably feed pigs pretty good things now when they're selling them the way they do now. But on a typical farm, you feed the pigs the slop. They don't get good food. They get the slop. They get the stinky stuff. They get the leftover stuff. And they eat it. They don't care. And when he first puts it, and I'm embellishing, but I think it fits. When he first puts it in the trough, to him, it's slop. He doesn't want to come near it. He's putting it, you know, at a distance, and he's getting away from it as quick as he can. Doesn't want to get it on himself. Doesn't want to smell it. You know, time goes by, and he gets hungrier and hungrier, and it starts to look better and better. You think you get hungry between breakfast and dinner, but few people know what real hunger is. When you get real hungry, and I've never been this hungry, but when you get real hungry, there's a lot of things you'll eat you wouldn't normally eat. And he looks at that slop, and he's so hungry, he's ready to dig his hands in there and eat some of it. And it's when he gets to that point that he says, wait a minute. I know that there are servants in my father's house who have enough to eat, and when they're done eating that, they've got enough to share with other people. And these are his servants. And I am out here perishing with hunger. Perishing. I could die out here from not having anything to eat. If I just start eating a slop, that's only going to last me so long. I think he realized I could die out here. He says, all right, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to my father's house. This is important. He says, I'm going to go back to my father's house, and I'm going to say to him these words. Father, I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned against you. And I'm no more worthy to be called your son. Let me as make me as one of thy hired servants. Hire me. I know I'm not worthy of you. Basically, he's saying, I know that I've lost your love. I've lost my standing as your son. And I know I can't get that back. But let me come into your house and be a servant. Because as a servant, I'll have food to eat. Now, my interpretation is he's in this for self-preservation. It's not so much that he wants to be near his father again. It's not so much that he wants to be where he was before. He really thinks he's lost that. He thinks that's out of the question. And now what he wants is a job. He wants to live his life. He doesn't want to die out there. But he thinks that in the process of leaving home and wasting his father's money, and probably tarnishing his father's name a little bit, if not a lot, he's lost his father's love. And so he says, it's a long shot, but I'm going to go back home. And he goes home, and he gets into the vicinity of his father's, he gets onto his father's land at least, in the vicinity of the house, and he's on the road back home, and his father sees him a great way off. And he runs out to meet him, he throws his arms around his neck, he kisses him, and the son says to him, Father, I've sinned against you, I've sinned against heaven, I've sinned against you, and I'm no more worthy to be called your son. That's as far as he gets, because his father pipes up and says, calls to his servant, says, bring forth the best robe, bring forth a ring, bring shoes and put them on his feet, kill the fatted calf, we're going to have a party, because my son that was lost is found, was dead, is alive. We're going to have a party. Now, I think it's significant that in this thing that he's recited to tell to his father, he only gets halfway. I think we can learn a little bit from that. Because when we come back to God for a new beginning, and that's what he experienced. He was the sheep that came back to the shepherd. He realizes what we will realize when we come back to God from wherever we've been or wherever we go, is that he'll accept our confession, but he will never accept our conditions. That's what the father was not going to accept. Even if he had gotten the words out, he would not have accepted his conditions. Certainly, we can see that from the way he greeted him. He greeted him in a way that he never expected. He's saying, look, I'm glad that you recognize that you've done wrong. But coming back into my house, you will never come back into my house as a servant. You will come back into my house as a son. And it will always be that way, no matter how many times you run away, no matter how many times you don't get it in your mind of what's really going on. When you come back here, you cannot lose my love. And you cannot lose your sonship. That's what the younger son had to learn from his new beginning. Was when he comes back home for this new beginning that he expects to be servitude and a paycheck and some food and some sustenance, he comes back to an abundance of love and an abundance of acceptance. So much more than he expected. And may we look to God for a similar new beginning and not think that we can lose God's love. There's so many of God's people who think they can lose God's love, who think they can gain it and lose it and gain it and lose it again. And I think it's even within us, even having the truth, it's possible for us to think, you know, I've just messed up so many times. He's not going to take me back this time. I've told him the same thing so many times. But you can't. It's love. Why? Because you'll never lose who you are. You can't break the fact that you're his son. You can't break the fact you're the sheep. So that intrinsic value that you think is there that goes up and down, and you maybe it does. Maybe if other people look at you, they're going to see you as less than what your parents see you as, is what God sees you as. But that intrinsic value has no meaning to them. A parent whose child runs away when they come home, they have lost no degree of standing. They're even more loved when they come home. It's when they left. It doesn't go down. It may go up, but it doesn't go down. And God's does not vary at all. It just stays sky high and doesn't move. And so may we ever come back to God when we become the younger son and leave him. Think that anything that he would... a way that he would wish for us to live is lawful, and think that some way he would wish for us to live is outside of our best interest. It's not. The things he tells us to do, basically, you're your own person. You can do it or not do it. But if we do the things if we live in his house, if we live under him, under his supervision, life is going to be better. Life is going to be better. So he comes home. It's a joyous occasion. He's come back with no reputation. He's come back with no money. He's come back probably smelling much worse than he went out. He's come back looking worse than he went out. But he's received home. And the father says, kill the fatted calf. Takes a long time to, I don't know exactly how long, but takes a while to fatten up a calf for a special occasion. He says, kill that fatted calf. Make a party. We're going to have a feast. We're going to eat that calf. We're going to drink some good wine. We're going to dance. We're going to have a good time. There's a time to dance, and there's a time to rejoice, as he was rejoicing over the return of his son. So they do that. They cook it all up. They start their feast, their party, and we get into the 25th verse. That says they began to make merry. And it says, now his elder son was in the field, and he came and drew nigh to the house and heard music and dancing. This was out of the norm. This didn't happen every day. And he said, he calls a servant and asks him, what do these things mean? What's going on? And the servant says to him, your brother is come, and thy father hath killed the fatted calf, because he hath received him safe and sound. You'd think that would be good news. It was good news. And you'd think it would make this older brother happy. You'd think he would be elated. You'd think, really? Okay. Beeline to the party. No, not at all. It says he was angry. He was angry and would not go in. Therefore came his father out and entreated him. He's upset. He tells his father in a second what he was angry about, why he's angry. And the father rebuts him to a degree. But I think you can see something about the father's character just in the fact that he came out to his son. He's lived with his son every day. He's probably even heard his older son's opinion of the younger son and what he was doing. And sitting there at the table, when the servant comes to him and says, your son's outside, he's not going to come in. Well, you know, that's just what's going on. And it would be easy for him to say, you know what? I expected that. Let him pout. I'm having a good time. That would have been easy for him to say. But he doesn't. He knows what his son's going to say. He was an intelligent man. This man probably didn't actually exist, but still, you know. He goes outside and he entreats his son. And his son says to him, he answered his father saying, lo, these many years do I serve thee. Notice what he says. This is the picture of the Pharisees. He says, these many years have I served thee, neither transgressed I at any time thy commandment. And yet thou never gavest me a kid that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this thy son was come, which hath devoured thy living with harlots, thou hast killed for him the fatted calf. He's saying to him, you're giving him the best, and you've never given me anything. I've been here, I've been the better son. I've done a better job of being your son than him. And therefore, I have earned your love, and you're not giving it to me. You're giving it to him when he hasn't earned it. Obviously, I have earned it, and I don't get it. What's up with that? You see, that's his argument. What is his argument to his... He's telling his father, you're wrong for doing this. And you're wrong for doing this, basically telling him the exact same thing as the Pharisees and scribes are saying about Jesus. He receives sinners and eats with them. Is he not? The exact same accusation. This guy came back and you let him in. Not only did you let him in, but you killed the fatted calf and you're eating with him. That's wrong. Because I should be in there as the man of the hour. And he's in there as the man of the hour. This is twisted. The father says to him, very simply, son, thou art ever with me. All that I have is thine. It was meet, or it was right, it was good, that we should make merry and be glad. For this thy brother was dead and is alive again, was lost and is found. And it ends there. It ends a lot like Jonah, where Jonah is mad about the fact that God saved the Ninevites. And he pouts and says to God, you know, I knew this was going to happen. Why did you bring me out here? This was a waste of my time. And God says to him, Jonah, it was right. It was, look at this city. It was, you got mad about the gore. This is another subject, but it ends in this way where he rebuts Jonah and says, basically, look, you're wrong. I'm right. It was right for this to happen. And it ends there. There's no secondary rebuttal from Jonah. There's no secondary rebuttal from the older son. So we can't say for sure, but I'm pretty sure, my opinion is, the older son didn't just say, you know what, Dad, you're right. I'm wrong. I've been totally, because all he said to him, he didn't present a compelling argument. He's just saying, look, you're wrong. This is the right thing for us to do. So I doubt that his comeback to that was, you know, you're right, let's go have a glass of wine and cut me off a piece of the steak. I don't think so. I think he kept his position. Now, knowing that he was a picture of the Pharisees, knowing that the younger son is obviously a picture of the scribes, the publicans and the sinners, basically illustrating again that the last shall be first and the first shall be last. That these people that you despise and revile, that have these bad activities in their life, that they are going to make up the New Testament church. And you people who are so religious, you're in a sinking ship. And you're going to stay in that sinking ship because you love that sinking ship. The law is dead. And you're going to stay in the law. And you're not going to leave it because you care too much about yourself. You care too much about your place in society. And you're not going to follow me. So, these people are the ones that are going to enjoy the feast, and you're the ones that are going to huff and puff and pout and stay outside. Why? Not because I kept you out, but because even though I, as he said, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets, how often would I have gathered you as a chicken does, as a hen doth her chickens, as a hen doth her chicks, but you would not. Why wouldn't they? That is one of the most important lessons, is that the Pharisees could have been a part of the New Testament church, but they would not do it. My question is, why? Why? There were reasons. Why is it the older son couldn't go inside? Why is it he wouldn't go inside? Let's look at the book of Galatians real quick. Do a little exercise in the fifth chapter. And I want us to look here and learn something about sin. Learn something about these two brothers and what they can show us about sin. And this is what makes it so intensely relevant to us. Chapter 5 of Galatians, we're going to look at verse 19. This is Paul giving us a list of the works of the flesh, which are the sins of the flesh, the things that the flesh does that are sinful. And we're going to go through this list that he makes. So useful that he does this. We're going to go through this list and we're going to attribute either each of the sins either to the younger son, the older son, or neither one. And there's some of these sins that won't. And we're going to see what happens. And for the sake of time and for the sake of just discretion, we're not going to look at them. We're going to look at them literally. You know, when it says witchcraft, we're going to look at it as witchcraft. Idolatry can be extrapolated. We're going to take it as dropping down to an idol. Okay? He says they are manifest. The works of the flesh are manifest. They're obvious. We can see them. They're not hidden. Which are these? Adultery. Now, again, for the sake of, you may not be comfortable with yelling out, younger son, older son, I'll just keep score myself. And if you disagree, I apologize. Adultery, younger son. You could say the younger son committed that sin. Fornication, younger son, 2-0. Uncleanness, just general uncleanness, younger son. Lived an unclean life. Didn't care that he did. 3-0. Lasciviousness. Lasciviousness means a loose sexual practices. Younger son, didn't care much about that either. 4-0, looking pretty bad. Idolatry, you could say that for both, but as I said, we're just going to say neither one of them, it's in the story at least, worshipped an idol. So we're going to say neither one. Witchcraft, neither one of them practiced witchcraft that we know of. Hatred, which one of them would you attribute hatred to? I would attribute it to the older son. 4-1. Variance. To be at variance. To be in similar to strife. I'd say older son. 4-2. Emulations. Emulation is similar to jealousy. I would say older brother. 4-3. Wrath. Which one had wrath in his heart? Could have brought wrath to acted in wrath. The older brother. I see 4-4. It's being split down the middle now. Strife. Easily older brother. 5-4. He's in the lead. Seditions. Sedition has to do with governments. Neither one. Heresies. Heresy has to do with, I believe, only with doctrine. I don't think we could attribute that to either one. Envyings. Obviously, older brother. 6-4. Murders. Neither one committed murder. Again, you could extrapolate, but we'll leave it at that. Drunkenness. Younger brother. He did that quite a lot. 6-5. Revelings. Reveling is when you're not only partying too hard, you're really partying too hard. There's no end to your partying. You just do whatever. It's pirates revel when they get on land. younger brother, I think you could say. That's what he was looking for. So it's 6 to 6. And such like. Am I the only one that's amazed by that? That when you look at Paul saying, okay, here's sin. Here's what sin looks like. Here's the way you identify it. You know, look out for sin. It's 6 foot tall, this color, that weight. He's saying, here's how you identify it. And when he does that, it splits down the middle between, at least in my estimation, and if your estimation is different, it's still going to be close between these two brothers. Yet, the first time I ever read the story, I'm kind of agreeing with the older brother. I'm thinking, you know what? If I had a brother that acted like that, I'd feel at least, if not exactly like he did, I'd feel similarly. I don't think it's hard for us to identify with the older brother. I think we can pretty well identify with both. But let us notice, and this is the eye-opening thing about it, is that the older brother, as we looked at in the beginning, in our preface, that if we say we walk in the truth and in the light, and we don't, the truth is not in us. The truth wasn't in this older brother. He thought he was walking in the light. He thought he was a good man. He thought he was a better man than his father. Okay? What changes you from walking in darkness thinking you're in light, and when you walk in darkness thinking you're in light, you are not just deceiving everybody else, or at least trying to, you have deceived yourself. Do you think this older brother would admit that he was a sinner? No. At least not in this context. At least not in this subject and in this instance. He would never admit. We don't have any evidence that he admitted it. I am not convinced that he even would have, at least in a short time after this occurrence. He is convinced he is in the right. He is convinced that he is right on this subject, and he has a stiff neck, and he will not change. He will not find any new beginning because he doesn't see that there's a need for one. Right? He has convinced himself, deceived himself to think that he is not sinning. These 6 sins and sins that are similar to them are the sins that will not get you a label of a sinner. No one's going to call you a sinner because you envy, because you have wrath, because you have jealousy, because you try to tear someone else's name down. Not so much. They're not going to call you a sinner. They're going to just debate on whether you were right or not. These sins, I'll call them stealth sins. Why? Because drunkenness and the other stuff that the sinners were doing, when God looks at them, the reason I said that's funny is that they're all sinners, right? We know that the inner circle and the outer circle around Jesus, it was just a big group of sinners, but there was one group that called the other group sinners. Interesting. Why? Because one group was committing one set of sins, and the other group was committing the other set. And the one that was committing the older brother's sins, the stealth sins, if you will, were not recognized as sinners. Why? Because they had convinced everybody else that what they did was not a sin. And the sins that they did in this way, they hid. And they even convinced to themselves that they were not sins. We will and do and have committed, will commit, sins that we don't even see as sins. And therefore, we won't see ourselves as being in the wrong. And when someone comes before us and says, you're wrong, we'll say, no, we're right. And that's as far as the argument will go until our minds recognize that it's possible for us to commit these kinds of sins. And we'll remain in the wrong, and there will be no progress. There will be no new beginning. But do you think that the father would have let the older son in the house if he had agreed with him? Sure. Do you think that the Pharisees, more of them, could have come over the line and been a part of the New Testament church if they had confessed? Yes. If they had said, you know what, I'm wrong. Absolutely they would have. Why is this important to us? Because the stealth sins, the older brother sins, are most, the people that are most susceptible to them are religious people. We don't have as much of a problem with the younger brother sins. Sure, some of us do. Some of us have drinking problems. Some of us have women problems. Some of us have the problems of idolatry and these other things. And really not that one. We didn't attribute that one. But some of us have the problem of general uncleanness, sexual problems. They're there. That is a problem. But it's in the... No. It's the problems of jealousy. It's the problems of, one brother thinking another one's doing the wrong thing, and so he thinks that the best way to go about righting this wrong is by tearing him down. No. Those are the things that tear churches apart. Those are the things that kept the Pharisees out. Those are the things that will keep us out. And that's why it's imperative, and above all importance, that we look for it within ourselves. And say to ourselves, I think I'm right about this, but am I right about this? To doubt our own, to doubt ourselves more. So that we don't come into the wrong, think we're in the right, and do a lot of damage to God's house, to our families, to all the things that the older brother missed out on. And that's, at the bare bones of it, that's what we miss. We miss a close connection with God. We miss a new beginning. We miss God saving us from ourselves. And He can and He will if we will only confess. You know what? I'm wrong. It's all Jonah would have had to have done. You know what? I'm wrong. I get what you were saying with the gourd. You're right. I'm wrong. The older son had just said, you know what? You're right. I'm wrong. It's a tricky thing. It's an easy thing to fall into. Forgot what I was going to say. Let's go to 1 John again once more and look at that in light of what we've said so far. If we walk in the light as He is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of Jesus Christ, His Son, cleanseth us from all sin. Not just the younger brother's sins, not just the older brother's sins. He cleanses us from all sin. Anything we can get ourselves into. And at one point in your life, you can be the younger brother. At the other parts, you can be the older. We are sinners. We're pretty good at both. He says He cleanseth us from all sin. He's always there. He doesn't change. We can't lose His love, and we sure can't earn it. And when we find ourselves thinking we've lost it, thinking we've earned it, we're pretty much in the same boat. We need a new beginning. We need a repentance. We need a confession. And for Him to renew us to where, just both of them were outside the house, were they not? And they were on two sides. One was in the field, one was in the hog trough. But they both needed to come back into the house. But just because we're in the field, may we not think that we're inside the house. The older son was basically what the younger son thought he was coming home to. You know, he would have given the reaction that he thought he was going to get from his father, right? The father was not the same man as the older brother. They had two ways of thinking. They may have been similar in their daily activity, right? But they were far different. Jesus said to the Pharisees, these people, you draw near to me with your lips, but your heart is far from me. When He came on the scene, they expected that He would give them accolades. They expected that when the Messiah came, they would be best buddies because they're doing what's right. He's going to come to do what's right, and it's going to be a great time when He comes because we're just going to be hand in hand. He's going to exalt us, and the kingdom's going to come, and we're going to be kings in the kingdom, and it's going to be great. But when He comes, He's different from them. He's over here, and they're over here, and they're thinking, why is He over there? Well, we're right, so if He's over there, He must be wrong. So they conclude that He's a sinner, and everything He does, they think is a proof that He's not who He says He is, and that He's not the Messiah, and He's doing the wrong thing, and He's beneath them. He receives sinners and eats with them. We're more than Him. He's less. May we be mindful that if we lived in that time, if we live in our time, this is no stretch. If we live in our time, it's easy to be them. Easy. I have. It's so easy to get jealous. How easy is it to jealousy springs up faster than a weed? Envy, so quick. Wrath, so fast. It doesn't take much to get that out of us. May we be vigilant watchers of this sin and not just think that as long as I stay out of the bar and as long as I stay off the street and as long as I stay away from these things, I'm good to go. No, you're just halfway there. And not only that we just seek to keep ourselves pure, but just look and notice when we are at a point where we need to return and know that we can. That's all it is. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. We deceive ourselves. That's the crux of it. Because I don't want to be deceived. And I really don't want to deceive anybody else. Not usually. We do sometimes in certain things we think is small and meaningless. But I certainly don't want to be deceived by anybody else. And I don't. Why would I want to deceive myself? But once that action has taken place, it's almost only God that can save me from it. It's almost only God that can save us from it. And I hope that just hearing that, knowing that it's possible to deceive yourself and to be vigilant and watching out for it, is the first step toward it being not happening, and when it does happening, it being corrected. And may we just live open, honest lives with ourselves. To be honest with ourselves first, so that we might be able to be honest with God, honest with one another, and experience these new beginnings over and over and over, no matter what camp we fall into, to experience them so that our church life is an open, honest, progressing, good, full of good things rather than the destructive bad things that come when we deceive ourselves and deceive each other. God bless you.